I'll tell you about multi-scale entanglement renormalization answers, which is second tensor network. But let's start with a brief summary of what you've seen about matrix product states. And you see my new strategy so that, well, I don't know if the font is too small. Can you see that well? There are lots of drawings, and I thought, let's not waste time drawing, or you know, me drawing things on the blackboard. So if I accelerate too much, just let me know, OK? But hopefully, I won't go too fast. So we had this wave function of n spins, or n latticides, and had exponentially many coefficients. And we drew this to represent all these coefficients. And then a matrix product state was a way of, in some sense, breaking this huge tensor into pieces that when you multiply them together, you get back the original state. And the whole point here was that if each tensor had a finite number of parameters, which could be d chi squared, where d was the dimension of each side and chi was the dimension of the Born index, then we had an efficient representation where d chi squared would be some technical prefactor that you can worry about if you want to implement these things in practice as a simulation method. But from a fundamental perspective, what's important is that this is only proportional to n. Okay, not exponential in n, but proportional to n. So we have an efficient representation. And then we discuss, can we efficiently compute with this thing? And you've seen during the lectures, but also as part of the tutorials, that there was a systematic way of, say, computing the scalar product, moving from left to right in a given way that allow you to do this with order cost, which is only proportional to n, and again, some prefactor. And same thing for expectation values of local operators. And so that was good. This was the first part. If we have a tensor network, we want to be able to efficiently specify it, efficiently manipulate it. But then the question was also, are these tensor networks useful for anything? Are they representing certain class of states that we are interested in? And specifically, can we use them to represent ground state? And then what we said is that we will look at structural properties. I'm reviewing this both to remind you of what we've seen, and because we're going to repeat these steps for Mera, for another tensor network. So what we saw is that the two type of structural properties that we looked at was the scaling of entanglement entropy and the scaling of correlations. So for entanglement entropy, that was very simple. Given a projector onto the pure state, if we want to compute a reduced density matrix, we just have to trace out part of the spins and or sides, and this corresponds to drawing these lines here. That's a trace over the first site, second site, and so on. And then the observation was that if we look at this object, this density matrix, we can see that it's connecting the bra and the ket indices through just two indices here. Okay? There is a way of reorganizing this in such a way that the only connections between the top and the bottom of this, the top indices and the bottom indices, right, is through two indices. So you see that? So that means that we can represent this density matrix. You know, you have to multiply these guys together. That's fine. But if you look at how many indices, what's the smallest number of indices you have to cut to split the bottom indices from the top indices from the bottom indices, you see that there are two Born indices only on your way. Okay? And so that means that the reduced density matrix can be expressed as a linear combination of several possibilities, but there is only a double index running from top to the bottom. And automatically, this means that this density matrix has at most rank, well, if each index can rank chi, if each index can take chi values, the double index can take chi square values. And so what this tells us is that the density matrix can at most have chi square eigenvalues. Okay? So if a density matrix can at most have chi square eigenvalues, that means that these eigenvalues, which are a probability distribution, will give you an entropy that is at most the largest possible entropy you can have with chi square values. And that's the flat distribution of chi square values. And this gives you log chi square, which is the same as 2 log chi. Okay? So you've seen all this in detail over the lectures and tutorials. And this was just a summary. Very good. And that meant that this is a constant. And what that means is that this is compatible with the saturation of entropy. As you consider larger and larger regions, the entropy of a region will be at most some constant. Very good. So we also saw correlations, and for correlations, we drew a tensor network corresponding to these two insertions here. At 0 and L, position 0, position L, we put two operators. And what we discussed was that this could be expressed as a vector, some metrics to the Lth power, or L minus 1, times a vector. And so what's going to happen here is that approximately what this, at long distances for large L, this is going to pick up the dominant eigenvalue of this transfer matrix, this eigenvalue lambda, right? And this will scale as an exponential, okay? So the idea, what we need to remember from here, is that if a two-point correlator can be computed, can be expressed as some transfer matrix problem with a number of, with some power of the transfer matrix, then this automatically will be some exponential decay with respect to this number of the power of this metric. Okay? So the conclusion was that the structural properties of a matrix product state, as far as correlations, we had this exponential decay and entanglement and saturation, and this was a match with ground state, the properties of ground states of one-dimensional gaps Hamiltonian. Okay? And this was no proof that this is going to be a good ansatz for ground states of gap 1D gap Hamiltonian, but it has the right properties at least. Okay, very good. So today we want to talk about another tensor network, the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or MERA. And the first thing to say is that it's going to be a wave function or a tensor network that represents wave functions, also of one-dimensional systems. So if the matrix product state was for one-dimensional systems, you can see here the open indices correspond to a one-dimensional array of sites. The open indices in the mirror are exactly doing exactly the same. They are still are organized in one dimension. Okay? But in the matrix product state, what we had is that all these tensors are just themselves a one-dimensional array, not just the open indices, but the tensors themselves. Whereas in mirror, what we are going to do is we're going to span the direction of space, this moves along the lattice, and also scale. We will move along an additional dimension corresponding to length scale or energy scale. We'll see that later. Okay? So in a matrix product state, we use a one-dimensional arrangement or a tensor network in one dimension to represent one-dimensional ground states. In the mirror, we use a two-dimensional tensor network to represent ground states of one-dimensional system. So with MERA, when we work with MERA, there are different representations. Sometimes you will see something like this. In this lecture, I'll switch back and forth between different representations. The difference between these two, apart from the color and whether there are circles or squares or triangles, is that here you have tensors that have two lower legs and then one upper leg. Whereas here you have tensors that have three lower legs and one upper leg. Okay. And that there will be some sense in which this represents a Coriolanian transformation. In this case, we're putting two sides together into one. Here we're putting three sides together into one. But fundamentally, there is no difference. It's just how fast you want to Coriolanian things. And sometimes the representation is more useful to argue about certain properties, structural properties, or sometimes this one is more useful. Okay? But there is no fundamental difference. Okay, so remember we had three questions we went to ask. A, B, C, the first one is about how many parameters go into specifying the ansatz. So again, we want to represent a wave function that depends on exponentially many complex numbers. And for the matrix product state, for n spins, we use directly n tensors. That's pretty clear because we attach a tensor to each spin or lattice site. And given, if we assume that each tensor, the one dimension does not depend on n, but it's a constant, then the number of parameters on each tensor does not depend on n, and therefore the total number of parameters is just proportional to the number of tensors, right? We've seen this three or four times by now. So then in MERA, what we have is n, we're trying to represent the state of n spins, and now we have this extra dimension, so for n spins, now the question will be, do we need more than order n tensors? And you've been asked this during the tutorial. So let's pretend you were not asked, and now somebody can tell me whether that's true or not. Do you remember this? You counted this, right, in the tutorial? So what was the conclusion?
There's two end ends.
Ordered ends still, right? You can actually precisely count them. And what you realize is that, and this counting is gonna will appear later on as well, or can appear in, you've seen this sum before actually. So the idea is that we have number of layers. In total, we may have log n layers, but each layer does not contribute equally to the total number of tensors. As a matter of fact, every time we change layer, we reduce the number of tensors by 2. And so you've seen this sum. We have that the total number of tensors is still linear in n. And where did you see this sum? Do you remember this from a toy model where we were counting contributions to entanglement of this simple toy model where we're saying that each length scale contributes some amount of entanglement? But you saw that in two dimension, right? So well, for now, what we need to remember is that this type of sums, this geometric explanations start appearing more and more, and there is the connections to geometry will become more and more important. Maybe who already knows why. There is some tomorrow. I'll try to tell you more about why or the role of geometry in this tensor network. All right. So we have order n parameters now. Can we efficiently, answer the first question? Yes, we have an efficient representation. Can we efficiently manipulate with this tensor network? And remember, for the matrix product state, that was cos 10, also cos 10. So how about with the meta? We have this. This is the ket. Now we want to compute ket times bra. So we're going to represent it this way. And now, in principle, what you see here is a two-dimensional tensor network. And from some of the tutorials, you know that when you have a two-dimensional structure, there is no way to efficiently compute that. Okay? You've seen that when you take the square tensor network and you try to contract the indices, that was exponential in the linear size of the square. But here, I didn't tell you the whole story yet. These tensors are not arbitrary tensors. Remember the quantum circuit model where we had gates that were unitary? And so if you have a unitary gate U and you multiply by its adjoint conjugate, then you get the identity. Well, all these tensors are actually constrained in a way that they are either unitaries in the sense that U times U dagger gives you the identity on the outer legs, or isometric in the sense that W dagger, now I'm in the representation of 3-to-1 tensors, they are still the identity on the single tensor, okay? W dagger. And so using these properties, now you realize that this is U dagger, so they will simplify, and the total cost is gonna be 0 because after these simplifications, what we have, so we have just used this property. Now we go to WW dagger being identity, so this is WW dagger, and so on, right? And you simplify the whole thing. And so the whole tensor network from the start has norm 1. We don't need to compute it. Okay, it's there. Is that a question?
So there's norm 1 within a floating point error, but don't we have to care about that if we're actually?
I'm not gonna worry about it. I don't know. What's the concern?
Well, if we're actually doing anything, if we were doing a simulation with this, we would have to measure the how far off the tensors were from the analytic properties we've assigned. Right? There's nothing in the computer that enforces the norm.
Right, but we will be enforcing these properties along the way of any simulation. So individually, each tensor will have this property to machine precision.
Okay, so you can guarantee that be true to less than no way besides contracting the whole network, you say?
Yes.
Okay.
So maybe there will be corrections of the order n corrections, order n times the machine precision, which is negligible.
Okay.
But this was just to know what's the norm of the state, and in general, what we want to know also is what the expectation value of a local observable. And again, this is a two-dimensional tensor network, so we need some kind of magic to efficiently contract this, or it's not going to happen. But the magic is again that there. We still have these properties, and applying these properties, we'll see a significant simplification here. So what's happening now is that everywhere we'll have simplifications as before, UU dagger, WW dagger, and so on. So lots of tensors will be cleaned up. But this one here cannot simplify with this one. This is your dagger, but there is an obstruction in between. So we cannot not apply the rule. And for the same reason, a number of tensors on top of those will not simplify. Okay? So we'll end up with a structure like this. And now the question is that the problem to efficiently contracting this thing? And the answer is no. And the reason is that actually, you can think of this now as a one-dimensional tensor network. It looks like two-dimensional, but actually it's one-dimensional, where the only dimension is a scale. Okay, so we just need to do a sequence of contractions that move us in scale, meaning upward or downward. And to see that, we can draw some boxes there and realize that let's look at this box first. We can contract this tensor network inside the box. Okay? There will be some cost attached to it. We have to multiply all these tensors together. There is no simplification. We really have to contract that. And there will be some cost, which will be some power of the bond dimension. Okay? But the observation is that when we're done with that, so we come here and we replace all these tensors in the red box by a single tensor, right? It had two upper legs, two lower legs, so that's what we have here. It's the result of this construction. Now, the next step that we have to take, it's very similar to the one we just took. So the idea is that you can do that, and maybe if the system was much larger, you would have to do that more times. But at each step, you always have the same size of a tensor. The tensor is of the same size. The type of manipulation you have to do to change from the first box to the second box and so on, these manipulations are always of some finite cost that is independent of the system size. Okay? So there is some leading cost, but the important, which is a prefactor, and then we need to do this a number of times. How many times? Well, if the system had size n, it takes log n steps to cover all the length scaled in the system. Okay? So the cost is actually only logarithmic in the system size. It's not even linear in the system. So to summarize what I just said, in Mera, what we have is there is no magic going on in the sense that we still have a two-dimensional tensor network. It's simplified into what looks maybe still two-dimensional, but it's actually one-dimensional tensor network. You could stretch it. You could pull it. We'll do it in a minute. And see that what you have is a transfer matrix or some form of transfer matrix in the scale. Okay, so the only dimension that is left after the simplification will be scale. And that is logarithmic in system size. Okay, so we have an efficient way of specifying the tensor network. We have an efficient way of extracting information from the tensor network. And now it's time to ask what type of properties this tensor network naturally has. And as usual, we'll look at decay of correlations and scaling of entanglement. So let's start with decay of correlations. And again, for the second time today, matrix product state, what we had is that we could express this expectation value as a transfer matrix problem, where we had a transfer matrix that was applied a number of times proportional to the distance between the insertions. Okay? And that automatically meant that there was some dominant eigenvalue to the alpha power, L being the distance between the two insertions. And that gave us the exponential decay. So what about the same thing or the equivalent thing in Mera? Let's look at this. So again, we have to draw the bra, the ket. So we have the ket here, the bra here, the two insertions. And now what we're going to have, and this tensor network, in this case, what I'm assuming is that the system is infinite and that the tensor network is homogeneous. So you see this tensor here. So there are only two types of tensors, right? Tensors with four legs, two to two legs, tensors three to one leg. And this is repeated everywhere at all scales. So this could go on forever. Okay? It could be a wave function for an infinite system. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put two insertions here at some distance L. And the moment you put insertions, those limit the simplifications that you can have in this tensor network. For the two-point correlator, meaning that you can still simplify this with this, but say not this with that, or not this tensor with that, because there are obstructions. But let's simplify them, this tensor network as much as we can, and that's what we get. Okay? I'll do it again. So if we simplify all the tensors that are have no abstraction, then we're left with something like this. And here what you see is that there is a self-similar structure. Okay? And now I'm going to take this thing, okay, this tensor network, and I'm just going to, let's see. Did I do that? Oh, I didn't do that. Okay, sorry. So what you can see is that you have to apply some operation a number of times. How many times? It's a linear map. What's important is that this operation that you're applying is just multiplying some. You can think of this as a vector being multiplied by some matrix a number of times. How many times? Well, as many times as needed until the two insertions become nearest neighbors. Okay. At this point, the rules change. Whatever needs to be done is something else. Okay. So the reason is the important point here is that you have two insertions. And in order to compute this expectation value, you'll have to do some linear map, apply some linear map a number of times, which is the logarithm of the distance between the two insertions. Right? Before, with MPS, you had to do some apply some linear map, a number proportional to the distance between the two insertions. Now it's not proportional to the distance, it's the log of the distance. Okay? And the reason is you're going to scale, and when you go to scale, to the distance between two points is divided by 2, or in this case by 3, every time you change the scale. Okay? So every time you change the scale, the distance is divided by 3. And after log 3 times doing that, log 3 of L doing, so if you start at distance L, after log 3 iterations, these two points become nearest neighbor. And then the rule changes. So the idea is that this computation here will demand having some transfer matrix applied log L, log 3 L times, and then some prefactor that we're not going to worry about. So again, if you have to apply some linear map log 3 L times or log L times, it's the dominant contribution will be some dominant eigenvalue that you pick up. So you have some eigenvalue multiplied it by itself log L times. But then we use this silly relation here, which says x log y equal to y log x, which means that if we have to apply some eigenvalue log L times, it's the same as applying, same as having L to log log something, okay? And once you have L log something, you have a power law, okay? So L to the log something is a power law. So again, we have a transfer matrix problem here. We have that we are applying some matrix or linear map a number of times. The difference with matrix product states is in matrix product states, the number of times we apply this linear map is proportional to the distance between the two insertions. Now it's not proportional to the distance, it's logarithmic in the distance. Okay? And that explains why we have a power law decay of correlations in this case. There was a question?
So in this example, you decided to place your operators in the middle left of your isometries.
Yeah.
Would it change a lot if you decide to place it as well?
The argument would have to change. What I did here was I carefully chosen where I place the insertions so I can just explain this story, right? So if I instead, so Javier's question is what happens if instead of putting blue the insertion here, I put it there? Well, then it will look more complicated. You'll still have to go log 3 L steps before these guys become nearest neighbor. But you won't see a clean transfer metric. You won't see that you are applying the same transfer. But that's OK. What I'm going to argue then is assume that this answer is good. It's translation invariant in the sense that it's good that very good. So the property just described didn't require making explicit the content of the tensors. I just said, imagine that the tensor, this tensor and this tensor and this tensor, they are all the same. Okay? So that we have a homogeneous meta where all the tensors are copies of the same tensor. And then automatically it follows that if I put insertions in given some given places, okay, the decay of correlations is powerful. So I made that argument a moment ago. Now, if in addition these tensors had been optimized to approximate the ground state, and they were doing a good job at that, okay, then it would follow that the ground state would have power law decay correlations on those points, but also everywhere else. But this does not follow from the structure of the tensor network. That's an extra layer. You have to optimize the tensors to accomplish that. So strictly speaking, I've only shown that in this tensor network, for given choices of positions of the two insertions, you have power law decay of correlation.
But in your arguments, you're now assuming that it's a good tensor network. That's exactly what you want to show.
No. I only, for the argument I gave before the question, said if we make insertions in given places, then we have power law.
Yes.
And that's all I want to say. That's all I want to say.
Okay, but that's not nearly as strong as what you could say about MPNs.
It is only for the places where selected places where you make the insertion. That's true.
Is there no way to argue why this is at least approximately translation invariant?
It's not translation invariant in the first place. So it is not true that this entity is as a variational class automatically. If you choose all the tensors to be the same, you have certain symmetry, which is scale invariant then, but you don't have translation invariant. So you give up natural translation invariance. In the MPS, if you choose all the tensors to be the same, you ensure translation invariance. In Mera, if you choose all the tensors to be the same, you ensure scale invariance, not translation invariance. So you give up translation invariance to get scale invariance.
Scale invariance is the only thing you need to prove that the two-point correlation functions decay algebraically, no?
No. It's scale invariant. Well, okay, this is not the continuous setting, it's a lattice. Things are more complicated than in the continuous. Okay? Anyway, the proof that you would have on the lattice has to do precisely with what I just said. Right. All right, so we have this power law decay of correlations. And that was a summary again, is a summary again of, just to reiterate a little bit, that we can have, if you want, a geometric interpretation again, which is that, the rule we have is always that the correlations decay exponentially in the distance between two points. But we need different, we can measure this distance, or what we mean by distance is distance within the tensor network. So the idea is that when we have an MPS, the distance on the lattice and in the tensor network are equivalent. Okay? If you want to go from one side to another side that is L sides away, you do it through L different tensors. So the physical distance which lives on the open indices, this is the distance on the lattice, and the distance in the geometry given by the tensor network are the same. But this is not true here in Mera. In Mera, we have, again, the physical geometry is done here, okay, on the lattice. But Mera itself proposes an additional geometry in one more dimension. And what I'm saying is that we could associate some naive notion of distance by counting given two points. We can ask, how many tensors do we have to go over? What's the smallest number of tensors we have to go over to connect one point with another one, right? So for instance, in here, we have to go through over L tensors jump over L tensors to go from here to here within the tensor network. Here, if we want to go from here to here, which is two points that are L sides away, we can take a path up and down the tensor network, which will only contain log L tensors. So there is some hyperbolic geometry in here that allows you to go from one place at the boundary to another place. So two points separated distance L at the boundary only takes log L steps. Okay. And in this drawing, it's not very clear, but if you had the huge lattice, and you would see the difference between L and log L very clearly. Going through the tensor network is always much, it's a much, much shorter path. Log L versus L. Very good. So that's what's happening, that there is some structure of geodesics, shortest path within the tensor network, and the structure of geodesics in the MPS in MIRA are very different. This is still linear, and the same as in the lattice, in the original lattice model. This one is hyperbolic, and it allows you to go to find much shorter path between boundary points. So as a matter of fact, the correlations are still exponentially suppressed in this logarithmic path, but the exponential of a log is what gives you the power law. In some sense, the correlations are always exponential in the distance, the geodesic distance, except that in this case, the geodesic distance within the tensor network is just logarithmic. Very good. So, entanglement entropy. We've argued that for an MPS, every time you want to cut a region of adjacent spins from the rest, you have to split or cut two indices. In MIRA, what happens is that the number of indices you have to cut depends instead on the size of the region A. So if we had a very small region A here, just to these two indices, we could cut it by cutting two indices if we want to go to a larger distance. So if A is larger, then we have to cut more indices. Again, the smallest number of indices that you have to cut is through a cut that goes up into the additional dimension, goes up in scale and then down again. Okay? Because this path is always just logarithmic, whereas this one would be linear. So the log always beats the log L always beats L. All right, so just by looking at the connectivity of the tensor network, just by looking at how the tensors are connected together, we can give an upper bound to the entanglement entropy and say that while in the MPS we've seen that that was a constant or area law, here what we have is a logarithmic correction to it. Okay? There is much more connectivity. If you try to split the tensor network in the MIRA into two pieces, you have to cut many more indices. How many? Well, log L. Okay, so an example just more explicitly is if you try to do this and try to look at what's the smallest number of indices you need to cut for L equal to 2, 6, 14, and 30, that was done explicitly, just to give you explicit example, then you see that indeed it goes 2, 4, 6, 8 indices that you need to cut. And that's approximately an asymptotically least log L. Okay. Any questions there? Okay, so now I want to. So we've completed this list of things we want to see. We saw that it's an efficient representation. We can efficiently manipulate MIRA. And now we've seen that it has the same structural properties as the ground states of gapless systems in 1D. And now I want to tell you more about maybe gain some intuition of what MIRA is trying to tell us about ground states. So ground states of critical systems can be efficiently manipulated. This does not follow from anything I said. I'm just adding new information now. Over the last 10 years, we've seen that this ansatz gives accurate description, an accurate representation, approximate but accurate representation of ground states of gapless systems, and also systems which may not be gapless but have a small gap, so there are many different length scales. The correlation length is very large. And now we would like to understand what the success of the representation is trying to teach us about physics. And so maybe to a good way to see that is by thinking that of MIRA as a quantum circuit. Okay? So the idea is that so far we had seen MIRA as a collection of tensors, and I already mentioned they had some constraints. They were unitary tensors or isometric tensors. Now what I want to do is I want to take any of the isometric tensors, these ones that take two legs into one, and extend them by adding an extra leg with a fixed number. And you know, every time you have, say, a vector or a matrix, you can add an extra let, an extra index if you fix that index, right? You're not doing anything. You still have the same number of elements. So what that means is actually that we can just look at any isometry as being actually secretly a unitary transformation where one of the inputs has been fixed to state zero. And so what we can do is we can go through this drawing and we can replace every single isometry with a unitary where one of the legs is fixed to state zero. And then if you are patient enough, you can spend, I don't know, 20 minutes drawing lines upward, okay, from here to here. I just stretch. I stretch all these zeros so that they go to the top. Okay. And now the result is the following. What we have here is an initial state, which is a product state of n sides or n quantum wire, and then some quantum circuit that is bringing together pairwise wires, so two wires at a time, apply a unitary transformation, and then split the wires again. Okay? And repeat with these two wires now, take a wire which is in a product state, and mix it here. Apply a unitary transformation. Okay? So this is really just a quantum circuit. The quantum circuit that starts with a product state, and there is this time here, which will end up being scale. In some sense, will represent scale. And so we can think of the mirror just as the result of a unitary evolution, okay, that takes a product state into some entangled state. And in this picture, we start with no entanglement. Okay, we start with n spins or n qubits or d-level system with no entanglement. And then we sequentially introduce entanglement through this unitary transformation in a very carefully organized way, in such a way that late times correspond. So if this is time, late times correspond to short distances, and early times correspond to long distances. Let me tell you in which sense late times correspond to short distances. So let's look at this thing here. I just argue it's preparing some entangled state down here. And now we could ask the question, what happens if I change my mind about this tensor here is a unitary transformation. It's mixing these two degrees of freedom. What if I change my mind about this unitary transformation? What if instead of doing certain things, I change the variational parameters and they do something else? Well, the result will only affect the wave function in here, in these two spins. Okay? It's a unitary change that they introduce locally into my system. So for instance, the reduced density matrix on the region will not know that I've changed my mind about this unitary transformation, that I've changed the unitary transformation down here. Okay? So there is a sense in which this last row of unitary transformations are only changing the wave function at short distances, say on the two degrees of freedom, the two qubits or qubits that are involved. But let's look at this one here. If I change this unitary transformation here, there is some propagation of the change all the way to a larger region down here. Okay? So if I change my mind about what I want to do, say here, I will change the wave function, at least, the wave function will be changed in a longer region. If I change my mind about this guy, the wave function will change everywhere. Okay? So the way this has been wired together is such that changes up here affect all of the wave function. Changes down here only affect local properties of the wave function. So this is good, because it means that we have a tensor network where we can store information about different length scales in different places of the network. Okay? If you want to store information about long distance behavior, well, this is done on these top tensors. If you want to store information about microscopic details, you do it down here. Okay? So in the matrix product state, we didn't have this possibility, right? Any information we wanted, whether it was long distance or short distances, you only had those tensors to store. Here we have the ability, at least the possibility, to store information organized by scale. So it's a variational ansatz where the variational parameters are organized both in space, in this direction, and in scale. Good. So another useful way of thinking about Meta is as in relation to the renormalization group. So right now, I just told you that we could think of this as a unitary evolution that prepares the ground state in some way, okay, organized by a scale. Now I want to think about, instead of going from the top to the bottom, I want to think about Meta also as allowing to constrain the system of going from microscopic degrees of freedom to long distance degrees of freedom. So to do that, we can go back to the 60s and ideas from real space renormalization group transformations pioneered by Leo Kadanoff. And what we would have there was this idea of spin blocking. The idea is that if they give you a very large system, you may not know how to deal with it because it's too large, too many degrees of freedom. But instead of panicking, what you can do is you can try to group the degrees of freedom into blocks, okay? And replace blocks of spins by effective spins in such a way that you have less degrees of freedom, iterate that, and see, you know, in some organized way, and see whether in this way you can at least still retain the long distance properties, the effective description of your system at long distance. So the basic idea there is that you just, and of course these ideas were not done, or let me tell you that these ideas were not implemented in quantum systems, they were implemented in the Lagrangian formalism for classical partition functions. And so I'm just taking the idea of putting together two spins. I'm not saying that that tensor networks were used in that context directly in the Hamiltonian formalism, where you just have, so this is the Hilbert space, and I'm just taking the idea of a spin block and applying it in the context of the Hilbert space, which is not where it was applied in the 60s. Okay? But in that case, the idea would be take every pair of spins, replace it with an effective spin. And in this way, you would obtain an effective lattice starting from your original lattice. Okay? So what you can think of Meta is proposing a slightly more elaborated construction where, if you recognize, this is one layer, a double layer of tensors in the Meta. Okay? So you can take this wave function now, take this double layer, and think of this double layer as proposing a cosgraining transformation. This cosgraining transformation maps the initial lattice into some effective lattice, which has half of the sides of the original one. So each black dot here is a side. And you see that every two sides of the original lattice is mapped into a single side, exactly as we would do if we just were doing spin blocking. Okay? But in spin blocking, we just take the two sides and replace them with a single one. Here, before we do that, before we take these two sides and replace them with a single one, what we see is that we have some tensors that are relating this side and these two sides that are going to be together. Well, this side is, there is a unitary evolution involving this side and the nearest neighbor one, and the other side and then its nearest neighbor one. Okay? So we're doing something there, something, you know, exotic, if you want. We don't know exactly why, what's the point. That's fine, but we see that it's more than just putting the spins together. Okay? Before we put two spins together, we let the spins interact with nearest neighbor in some way. So exactly how does this work, or what would be the point of this? Okay, so remember what an energy transformation should be doing. Should be taking your degrees of freedom and replacing them with whatever it's important at longer distances and removing from the description short distance details. So what happens if we happen to work, if we start with a wave function that where these two spins are entangled? Imagine that these two spins are in an entangled state. Then, because these two spins are going to become the same one, it's no problem. Whatever entangled correlations you have there, these two spins may be in a pure state, and that means that this guy is going to be in a pure state. So whatever correlations you had, which were within a spin block, are going to disappear from your system. But this is good news, because these are short distance details, and the cosgraining transformation should be removing short distance details. So same thing happens with Meta here, that the correlations between neighboring spins, where the two spins are going to be blocked into a single spin, will be removed under cosgraining, because correlations between two spins that are becoming a single spin stop to exist. There are no correlations left, right? But what happens in this picture if the correlations were not between two spins that are going to become the same effective spin, but two spins which are going to become halves of two different effective spins? Okay. Well, in that case, the correlations existing between two spins are going to be promoted to longer range correlation. Right? This spin will be part of this effective spin. This spin will be part of this effective spin. If they were correlations, the two effective spins will be correlated. But this is a problem because we are treating short distance correlation in different ways, depending on whether the two spins will be blocked together or they will not be blocked together. In one case, the correlations disappear, as they should, because we're trying to obtain a description that gets rid of short distance properties. That's the point of having an effective description. But those correlations here are going to not disappear, but actually be promoted to longer distance correlations. And that's against the rules. That's conceptually, that's not what we wanted, what we should demand of a renormalization group transformation. So this just spin blocking alone fails to remove short distance entanglement. It's part of the short range entanglement. And the point of these disentanglers is precisely to capture this short-distance entanglement between blocks. Okay? You allow for extra possibilities here, such that if there was short-distance entanglement between two spins that are going to become parts of different effective spins, then you have a chance to remove it from your system. Okay? Just, you know, it's a change of basis that, in particular, could take an entangled state into a product state if needed. Okay, so in this way, this extra layer of what we call these entanglers, these tensors here, are there to remove, to allow for removal of all short-distance entanglement, regardless of whether it's placed within two spins, correlating two spins that are going to become the same effective spin, or two spins that are going to become half of two different effective spins. Okay, is this clear? This is just a story I'm telling you. I mean, in practice, it might be more complicated, but what I want you to take from this is that there was no way in this scheme where we just block the spins. In this scheme, there was no way to treat correlation, short-distance correlations in different places in the same way. Some short-distance correlations were removed very nicely. Some short-distance correlations were upgraded to longer-distance correlations artificially. Okay? And that's the point of having this entanglement. Is there a question?
How do you see that all of them are removed? We're just choosing.
Maybe I should say we are trying to, okay? Because it doesn't follow from a drawing that you succeed. In practice, we see that that's what's happening. But
so we're just choosing some matrices so that it removes all of them.
It removes them sufficiently that whatever is left, if something was left, there will be a new layer of disentanglers and isometries in the next level, and it will be removed eventually within, you know, one or two layers. So it does. It's not necessary that we really capture all short distance entanglement, that we remove it all at that stage. It's important that we remove it soon. But MERA comes with a concatenation of such layers, right? And so what's important is that short distance entanglement does not get to the top, that it's removed sufficiently fast, say within one or two layers. Question?
But in practice, we build the matrices and then we create an entangled state, right? It's not like in practice we have an entangled state and we create matrices that they take it away. I mean, we don't know what the state is because the state is a Gram state, and that's the whole point, to find the Gram state.
That's fine. There is a lot of technology that goes into optimizing tensor networks, and MERA in particular, and I'm trying to not go there.
No,
I just want to point out that these tensors, there is an interpretation of, you know, you can look at this tensor network and say, okay, it has two dimensions, it has colors and, you know, some legs connected in a funny way. Or you can give it a layer of interpretation. And one interpretation would be, you can think of this as a quantum circuit that is preparing a wave function by introducing correlations at different length scale in an organized way. And another interpretation is here what you have also is a linear map from a lattice, the original lattice, to an effective lattice. And if you want to understand what's different from just having spin blocking, it's this layer of disentanglers down here. And what they give you a chance to, in the picture where you're constraining the system, they're giving you a chance of removing entanglement. In the picture where you go from the top to the bottom as a unitary evolution, these matrices are introducing entanglement. In the opposite direction, they are removing entanglement, just at this intuitive level. Okay, I usually, every talk I do this, wasn't that bad. So when I said this is a tensor network for a wave function, actually, if you think about it, it's a tensor network for several wave functions. Because if I start removing layers of tensors, I started with the wave function for the original lattice. But if I remove a double layer of tensors, now I have a tensor network for some wave function for an effective lattice with half of the size. Okay. And if I remove yet another layer, I have a tensor network for another effective lattice with 1/4 of the sides that started from, and so on. So what we have is not a wave function, but a sequence of wave functions given by the tensor network. And this has all the flavor of a renormalization group flow. And that's what Meta is doing for you. It's giving you an RG flow in the space of wave functions. And so the same way that you are used to thinking about the space of couplings of Hamiltonians, and then you change scale, and the couplings are modified accordingly, and then there is this flow with fixed points corresponding to stable fixed points corresponding to gap phases, and maybe unstable fixed points corresponding to critical phase transitions, and so on. You could play this game, but instead of working in the space of couplings of the Hamiltonian, you could work in the space of wave functions as given precisely by tensors. So there is this picture that Meta provides a realization of the RG, the renormalization group ideas, in the space of wave functions. But this encounters some opposition at the beginning, thinking, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I know what RG is in the space of Hamiltonians. I'm very comfortable with that because I've studied this for many years. It's in the books. Well, there is no need to panic because what this is doing is giving you an RG in the Hilbert space. So you can apply it to wave functions. It's a linear map. It's mapping the Hilbert space of this lattice into the smaller Hilbert space of this lattice. But of course, if you know how to transform state, how to do an RG on state, automatically you know how to do an RG on operators, in particular on Hamiltonian. So the idea is that once you have this RG transformation, we can apply it to local operators. So this would be a local operator on the original lattice. It's local in the sense that it's equal to the identity on most sides, except for three central sides. Okay? This represents, instead of sigma x on one side, it's sigma x, sigma x, sigma x, okay, on three contiguous sides. It's some operator acting on three sides. The idea is that now we know how to transform this local operator. And the constraining, we just need to apply the constraining transformation as a ket and as a bra, okay? Right? If states transform by applying an operator, operators transform by conjugation. So when we do that, now this doesn't look like a local operator anymore, but remembering that this is U and this is U DAGA, there are simplification rules. When you apply the simplification rules, what do we find is that the final operator is still local. It's acting only non-trivially on three contiguous sides of the coarse grain lattice, right? It's the identity on the rest of sides. So the idea is then that if you start with a local Hamiltonian, which is sum of sides terms, since this is a linear map, a sum of each local term is mapped into a local term, it's coarse grain into a local term, and so your local Hamiltonian with the sum of local terms is mapped into an effective local Hamiltonian, which is still sum of local terms. Okay? So we have a linear, we have an RG group in the space of wave functions, but also in the space of operator. Okay, and then it's almost time, but I think this was my last slide. So the idea is that this in the end is just a proposal how one could go about constraining a lattice system, the Hilbert space of your quantum lattice model. It's a proposal, and you need to prove that it's useful, not by drawing things and talking for hours, but actually by actual numerical simulations. And of course, in this course, I'm not discussing how to do the simulation. So now I'm just going to inform you of what happens when you turn this into a computational approach. It turns out that when you do that, maybe you saw this in the colloquium that I gave some time before Christmas, that it turns out that after optimization, which I'm not discussing, of these tensors, and which involve energy minimization of so given a Hamiltonian, say the Hamiltonian for the criticalizing model, we can optimize these tensors. And after optimizing them, we have that local operators are mapped into local operators. And from that, we can identify local scaling operators of the theory. And remember, we've been playing around for the first week. We talked about the scaling operators, scaling dimensions, conformal spins. There was this operator state correspondence, and we were looking at the energies and momenta of the low energy states of the Ising criticalizing model, right? We were talking about properties of the low energy states. Well, those properties are related to the properties of local scaling operators of the theory through this operator state correspondence. And now what I'm going to talk is directly about local operators. Okay? I'm not de-analyzing a Hamiltonian and looking at low energies. I'm looking at what local operators on my lattice are transforming to themselves under Coxgrain, under a scale transformation. And when I do that, I can do that by de-analyzing this scaling super operator here, a linear map that maps local operators into local operators. And then I can identify scaling dimensions, conformal spins, and operator product expansion coefficients. And numerically, what you see is that you recover the results compared to the exact solution. So this should be 1/8, 1 plus 1/8, and so on. And you see that you get very accurate. That should be, 1/8 again, so 0.125, and there are some small errors attached to that. Okay? So basically, we can extract the universal information about an RG fixed point from this procedure, which means that it's, which we take as a strong evidence that this procedure is properly implementing the ideas of the RG flow. Okay? It identifies fixed points where you would expect a fixed point. And this fixed point is such that from it you can get all the scaling of dimensions correct. OK, and that concludes what I wanted to tell you today about Mera. It's time, so it's a good time to stop. Questions?
Yeah, so you have like a super operator working on those operators there, right? Which means that you can just diagonalize the super operator and then find the scaling dimensions. But you also have OPE coefficients there.
Yes.
How do you find them?
So the idea is that when you de-analyze this scaling super operator, this linear map that changes the scale, the eigenvalues correspond to these scaling dimensions or are related to the scaling dimensions. But the eigenvectors themselves are operators that live on the lattice and that are the scaling operators. Once you have those guys, you can ask the question, what if I place one here, one there, and I cosgrain this? And the cosgrain, we've seen that the insertions become closer and closer to each other, and eventually they fuse. Okay? They keep getting closer, and when they are nearest neighbor, the next step that we cosgrain, they become one thing. And at that point, you can re-express the result as a linear combination of a scaling operator. And the coefficients in this linear combination coincide with the operator product expansion coefficient. It's all very physical. We're implementing it on the lattice. So instead of the continuum, you have to take into account that there is a shorter distance. So fusion means what happens when you have located the two scaling operators together. The next step, they'll become the same thing. They'll become supported on the same. The product becomes supported on the same side, or two sides, or whatever it is, and then that thing can be re-expressed in terms of the local scaling operator, and this linear combination has the right coefficients in front. There is also, as you probably know, the operator product coefficients can be extracted from three-point correlators, and that's another thing you can do. You can put three of these scaling operators and evaluate them together. So if there are no more questions, tomorrow is the last lecture. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give you more perspective. We're going to go to higher dimensional systems. I'm going to try to touch a little bit on different topics. Maybe we'll have time for a little bit of holography, but not a lot. Definitely not a lot. Maybe relation to statistical mechanics. I'll see how much time we have.